The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the last program of the week. Glad that you're here with us to finish off the work week the right way. Thanks to Richard Palmer for sitting in for me yesterday, or standing, depending upon his preference. But he was down here in the cellar filling in on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, giving me a little extra time to do some other things. So thanks to him and all of our wonderful substitutes. We've got some here. We've got some at Edmund. And we really do appreciate their efforts. This weekend, by the way, on the Key of David, my father's program, I think it's from 2009, Haggai Shaking the Nations. I went through a chunk of that in a message recently. It's a great little booklet. So it'll be a great review, even if you saw it years ago. It's been quite a number of years now, 2009. So make sure that you set aside some time to listen to or to view that program, Haggai, Shaking the Nations. Quite a few headlines that I want to run through here before we get to the main topic that I want to discuss here in this first segment. The Times, just this headline mainly, 10 EU leaders hold crunch summit on migrant crisis. Of course, you know of the ongoing struggles with Angela Merkel to keep her coalition together. And here are, as the Times brings out, 10 EU countries that are holding this emergency immigration summit. I believe that's going on this week, or this weekend, rather. And of course, students of Bible prophecy are well aware of what Revelation 17 and verse 12 says about the 10 kings. And so we know that the 10 that come together, these are going to be the ones that rally around that Daniel 8 strongman. So lots of these things converging. Of course, as I said, Miss Merkel, I mean, here she is really in danger of losing her leadership position. There was a, I think there was a, where was this poll? 43%, it says here. 43% of Germans want for Merkel to leave office. That's pretty amazing. You see the tide of public opinion in Germany. It's swinging in the direction of those who want border security. And, of course, if you switch over to the United States, there was a Rasmussen poll just recently about the illegal immigration crisis, everything that the media are working to manufacture, as I've discussed this past week. But it says a majority of Americans blame illegal immigrant parents for the child crisis on our border, America's border. A majority of Americans blame illegal immigrant parents. Where do you see that in any of the news coverage? All of the blame is put upon Donald Trump's shoulders. And yet, and it's good for those Americans, a majority of them, that see through all of this agenda coming from the left-wing media to bring down a president. And there's enough common sense, at least with a simple majority, to know that, look, what are the parents doing? What are the parents thinking? How could the parents subject their children to this kind of a journey, to this kind of a trek? And yet, that's what's happening. Well, we covered that earlier in the week. I don't want to dwell on it too much here today, but it remains in the news. Carolyn Glick, by the way, commenting on all these comparisons to Nazis, saying Donald Trump is Hitler. And here is... she brought out in her piece, I didn't bring it here with me, I just brought one little quote, but she says in her piece that, well, here's Donald Trump getting together on Hanukkah with his Jewish grandchildren, of all things, and he's the one that they're saying is Hitler. And the border police, I guess they're the Nazis. It says, by attacking Trump, this is Carolyn Glick, the most pro-Jewish president in living memory as a Nazi, while ignoring the dangers of the growing power and numbers of anti-Semites in their own party, Jewish Democrats are doing themselves no favors. So long as Jewish Democrats go along with the rise of anti-Semitic forces in their party, on the one hand, and assault the Republicans as Nazis, on the other, the situation will only get more dangerous for them and for the Jewish community in the U.S. as a whole. It's an upside-down world here, the Democratic Party. They put their arms around guys like Louis Farrakhan and then just so casually label Donald Trump and others who support him as Nazis. Rush Limbaugh the other day, I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before, but he said if this hysteria continues, someone's going to get killed. I mean, that's quite a statement, and I'm sure his critics are saying that he's just guilty of hyperbole. But look at the coverage. Look at the hysteria. Look at the lies in the media. They're so obsessed with bringing down a president, they won't tell you the truth. As I heard from one commentator yesterday or the day before, he asked about, you know, in all of this coverage about immigration, when do you ever see a program about, well, this percentage of immigrants are coming in who are actually hardened criminals, and they make up this percentage of the prison population in California or Arizona or Texas, and they've committed this many murders, and they've split up this many families, this many American families. And we just thought, in the interest of fairness, that you'd want to know. We want to give you both sides. In our heart of hearts, we're for open borders. They might as well just say it. But just so you know, with those open borders, there are some dangerous elements that are coming in among them. You never see a report on CNN about that. I mean, you have to search far and wide just to get the most recent statistics of illegal immigrants who are in the U.S. prison system. They make up a significant chunk, a pretty significant percentage. And maybe we can elaborate on that further in the weeks ahead. But you just don't see it because they only want to tell one side. They only want to tell their side, the radical leftist side, the fundamental transformation side, the Barack Obama side. And so they conveniently leave him out of all of these detention centers, his involvement, what was going on during his presidency. They protect him. They do everything they can to protect Barack Obama, to protect Hillary Clinton. And here are these top Obama officials, like I mentioned the other day, Michael Hayden, who comes out and says, yeah, it's Auschwitz, sure enough. That's what these detention centers are. Well, the president comes out then and signs an executive order to put a freeze on this so-called separation of families. And of course, his critics are not going to be happy with that either. Nothing he does will satisfy them. Nothing. The Federalist makes the point I was trying to make the other day about these broken families. A deeper question lurks beneath this sudden concern for the welfare of children at the border. The repercussions associated with broken attachments and disrupted bonding are widely known and extensively searched. In other words, as the title brings out, why do broken attachments only matter for border-crossing children? And then the article goes into all of these other examples where, as I said the other day, the left-wing media and so many in the Democratic Party are for breaking up families. They are all for splitting up the children from parents. And so why does this matter now only for border crossing children? Well, of course, it serves their liberal ideological aim. That's why. In Yahoo News, I want to spend a little bit of time on this because we've touched on this before. book that's coming out, Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. We've referred to that before, and then also that, what was that, that CNN report from last year, I believe, or no, it was just earlier this year, March, I believe. We played clips, this guy that was in the Obama White House basically sounding the alarm about Russian meddling in the U.S. election process. And, well, this new book points out how that when they learned of this in the White House cybersecurity team, they went right to work defending the United States, locking things down, protecting the White House. And then it was Susan Rice who came in there and told the White House security chief, you stand down. Stop with this. Don't get ahead of Barack Obama. You let him make the decisions here. And so anyway, this fellow, he's giving a testimony at Capitol Hill on Wednesday. The Yahoo News piece, though, says the Obama White House's chief cyber official testified Wednesday that proposals he was developing to counter Russia's attack on the U.S. presidential election were put on a back burner after he was ordered to stand down his efforts in the summer of 2016. And this is how the exchange went on Capitol Hill, clip one.
But as far as your cyber response, you were told to stand down. Is that correct?
We were, those actions were put on the back burner. Yes, we were, that was not the focus of our activity during that time period.
Not the most emphatic answer, and we'll talk more about the rhetoric that you hear so much today. But he was asked point blank, you were told to stand down, right? And instead of saying yes, he said, well, kind of. It was put on the back burner, so he softened it a little bit for who knows what reason. But the Yahoo News piece, it says a little bit further on, they came during a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing on, this was on Wednesday, regarding this Russian cyber and information warfare. It says the view that the Obama administration failed to adequately piece together intelligence about the Russian campaign and develop a forceful response has clearly gained traction with the intelligence committee. And it cites some senator that said that we were caught flat-footed and didn't do anything about it. And of course, the bigger point to make here, as we've made before, is that they all assumed Hillary was going to win, so they didn't want to draw attention to it. So they did stand down. They didn't aggressively go after it. It says the conclusion was reinforced Wednesday by another witness, Victoria Nuland, who served as Assistant Secretary of State for Europe during the Obama administration. She told the panel that she had been briefed as early as December 2015 about the hacking of the Democratic National Committee, long before senior DNC officials were aware of it, and that the intrusion had all the hallmarks of a Russian operation. It says, finally, as she and other State Department officials became more alarmed about what the Russians were up to in the spring of 2016, they were authorized by then Secretary of State John Kerry to develop proposals for ways to deter the Russians, but most of those steps were never taken. They knew the danger was there. They knew Russia was interfering. They knew in 2015. They knew all the way through 2016. And then when the Obama White House started to do something about it, they were told to stop. They were told to stand down. And then now comes the testimony from Wednesday. And who knows why, as I say, he softened it a bit. We were told it was on the, it was supposed to go on the back burner. Truth fails, as I said the other day, Isaiah 59:15. It's just harder and harder to get to the truth because people are going to believe what they want to believe. I suppose even following that testimony, still, people will be able to take one side or the other. Andy McCarthy, in writing about the IG report and just all of the distortions that have come after the fact, the FBI director, Christopher Wray, congressional Democrats. I played that contrast for you the other day, the montage with all those statements from the inspector general, bias, bias, bias. And then Christopher Wray coming along, who's sitting right alongside him in the same hearing, saying there is no bias. All of these distortions, as Andy McCarthy brings out, they blithely assert that the IG found no bias in the FBI's decision making, and he says that claim insults our intelligence. Well, look, are we reading the same document here? That's an insult. That's an insult to our intelligence. Look at the facts that are right in front of our face. That's what McCarthy is saying. Let me just repeat some of those bits that I played for you yesterday. This is Michael Horowitz, the inspector general, at the hearings earlier this week. Clip two.
We did not find no bias with regard to the October events.
We did not find no bias with regard to the October events. I went through Cheryl Atkinson's piece from Wednesday, remember, where she's like, well, you know, the double negatives here don't help. We did not find no bias with regard to the October events. Here's another example, clip three.
What we say here is not, as Senator Crapo mentioned, which is that there was no bias.
What we say here is not, as Senator Crapo mentioned, that there was no bias. And then one final example, clip four.
And we were not convinced that that was not a biased decision.
We were not convinced that that was not a biased decision. Over and again, the double negatives. Over and again, we're not saying, there's literally a billion things the IG report doesn't say. But what does it say? What are you saying? 560 pages. What's the, and then you got to have two hearings. You've got to go to the Senate. You've got to go to the House. And then you've got to be asked questions by the Democrats, and you've got to be asked questions by the Republicans. What are you saying? Well, we're not saying, what we're not saying is this. Okay, but what are you saying? Truth fails. And that same verse in Isaiah says that he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. I mean, there's a connection there. If you stand up for the truth and depart from evil, you're really going to set yourself up to be a prey or a target. They're going to come after you for telling the truth. Victor Davis Hanson, in going through that IG report, and he's written on this before, even back during the years of the Obama administration, just the language that was used to try to obscure the truth. He says about this IG report, these phrases and things that they made up or that they changed in order to sanitize the scandals. He says an early draft of the 2016 FBI report on the email scandal was reportedly subjected to linguistic surgery to exonerate the former Secretary of State, who at the time was the Democratic nominee for president. Clinton was originally found to be grossly negligent in using an illegal email server. That legalistic phrase is used by prosecutors to indict for violation of laws governing the wrongful transmission of confidential government documents. So that's in the statute. We've covered this before, too. I mean, grossly negligent, that's all you have to be in order to be indicted. So that was watered down to extremely careless. She wasn't grossly negligent, Director Comey said. She was extremely careless. We had to scrub grossly negligent from one of the earlier drafts. And we finished with this. Hanson says FBI investigators also had concluded it was reasonably likely that foreign nations had read Clinton's unsecured emails. Comey intervened to mask such a likelihood by substituting the more neutral word possible. It's possible. Remember all the interviews when he came out with his book? It's possible. It's possible. And we went through that, didn't we? Okay, what is possible or what is not possible? Again, you're talking about a jillion things. But what happened? What is the truth? He opts for the more neutral phrase. It's possible that they could have been taken, those emails. It's possible that they could not have been taken. It's possible that they not could have not been taken, to use the double negative. It says Barack Obama, while president, was found to have improperly communicated with Clinton over her illegal server while she was in a foreign country. Obama had denied that fact by falsely claiming that he never learned of her server until much later, after it was publicized in the news. So I played that for you on Wednesday. He said he didn't know anything about the server, and we come to find out now because of the IG report, a little footnote tucked away on page 89, we come to find out that he was emailing her at clintonemail.com. Hansen says the FBI hierarchy under Comey tried to hide the embarrassing details of Obama's conduct. Now listen to this. This is Comey while he presided over the FBI. As a result, the FBI deleted Obama's name from its report. In its place, the FBI inserted the laughable another senior government official. That was referring to Barack Obama. As if the president of the United States were just another Washington grandee who had improperly communicated on an illicit email server. And on it goes. Loretta Lynch telling Comey, make sure you don't use the word investigation. This is a matter, you see. It's not an investigation. It has to be the more neutral word. It's just a matter that we're looking into. Hansen says one of the oddest mysteries of the IG report is the FBI's delay in addressing the fact that disgraced former U.S. Representative Anthony Weiner had a number of Clinton's private emails on his unsecured laptop. They were all forwarded to him by his wife, Huma Abedin, an aide to Clinton. Their Washington insider marriage had been widely publicized for years, but Comey, the nation's premier public investigator, told the inspector general that maybe he didn't know they were married. He maybe did not know. Comey would have the investigation believe that Abedin had forwarded numerous emails from Clinton, some of them classified, to a mere acquaintance. And this is continuing from Victor Davis Hanson's piece. It says, and look closely at this Orwellian profession of ignorance about the Weiner-Abedin marriage. This is quoting Comey. He said, during this investigation, during an interview, he said, I don't know that I knew that Weiner was married to Huma Abedin at the time. I don't know that I knew, he said. Translated, that means Comey claimed that he was not sure at one point that he was sure at another point that Weiner was married to Abedin, at least at the time when the emails came to his attention. Therefore, he did not act as he should have. And again, what any of this has to do with why they didn't reopen the investigation in early October 2016 as opposed to late October. I mean, who knows? Who knows whether he's married to her or not? It's worse if he isn't. Because then, like Hansen brings out, here are all these emails ending up on an unsecured laptop of an acquaintance, not even the spouse. But this is just common. This is the top investigator, or he was, the top investigator at the FBI in the United States of America. I don't know that I knew that Weiner was married to Huma Abedin at the time. Hansen says, what were the common themes in the FBI's linguistic distortions? Two realities. One, the FBI made sure that Obama, the boss of most most of the wayward FBI and DOJ officials would not be entangled in any scandal. They came up with all of these linguistic distortions to protect Barack Obama. And the other common theme, like Hansen brought out in one of his columns earlier this week or last, they were all operating under the assumption that Hillary Clinton would win, that Donald Trump would be humiliated on election night. It says the inspector general's, well, further on, he talks about how this is just covering the Hillary Clinton scandal, the email server scandal. And now there's other investigations that are underway about how they got those warrants to wiretap, the spying, the investigation into the Trump-Russia collusion story. And those things are going to start trickling out as well. And more it's like my father said in the Saving America article. I mean, the more and more they get into this, the more and more the radical left is being exposed. I saw a headline. One of our listeners sent me the link to it just the other day. James Clapper saying that he hopes that the Mueller investigation ends soon. I think there's probably more from that radical left contingent that hope that this will be over soon so that the investigations can stop. Because they're being exposed. But look at the language. Look at the language that's used. Hansen says, if the IG report on the Clinton email scandal is any guide to these upcoming investigations, expect widespread abuse of the English language to warp reality. Well, they'll come out, these other reports. And they'll be condemning. They'll expose a lot of evil, a lot of wrongdoing, a lot of illegal activity. But it's all going to be sanitized, you can be sure. We're seeing it happen right now in real time. Hansen says the media is using the antiseptic informant in place of the cruder but more accurate spy or mole. The off-putting but accurate wiretapping has become the more professional surveillance. The sanitized improper always sounds cleaner than the more accurate illegal. In sum, he says, 2016 could make a logical sequel to 1984, a reference, of course, to George Orwell's classic text, his classic novel that goes by the name 1984. That America, Saving America Temporarily article, we've referred to that over and again since it came out a few months ago. But together with that, there's a sidebar piece in there by Dennis Leap, one of our staff writers, about 1984 and the liberal left mindset. And in that piece, he says one of the most chilling scenes in 1984 comes near the end when a high official from the Ministry of Truth, it's all about the truth for the Ministry of Truth, this character named O'Brien, is re-educating the book's protagonist, Winston Smith, using horrendous torture. The character Winston naively believed the party took control of the government because people can't govern themselves. O'Brien sets him straight. Dennis Leap says here, after giving him a painful shock to punish him for his wrong idea, he states the party seeks power entirely for its own sake. We are not interested in the good of others. We're interested solely in power, not wealth or luxury, or long life or happiness, only power, pure power. Power is not a means, it is an end. This thinking, Mr. Leap writes, is consistent with the actions of the left in America today. You see, it's all about power. And they lost power, at least in the White House, in 2016, November of 2016. And that explains everything you need to know about what they've been doing since. They are in full-scale panic mode. And you see it with the illegal immigration going on at the southern border of the United States. They want to return to power. It's all about power. It's anything to make the current president look bad and hopefully bring him down so that they can return to power. These tactics, I mean, as Dennis Leap brings out in that short article, there's an ominous familiarity to them today. He said in the same torture scene, O'Brien commands Winston under duress of pain to say that 2 + 2 = 5. Winston is baffled. How can I help but see what is in front of my eyes? He asks desperately. 2 and 2 are 4. Sometimes, Winston, O'Brien says, sometimes they are 5. Sometimes they are 3. Sometimes they are all of them at once. You must try harder. It's not easy to become sane. That's from George Orwell's book, 1984. Look at all of the contradictory ideas and so-called truths that are disseminated today. Look at what's being forced down the throats of our young people in university today. Well, go back and look at that that article, 1984, by George Orwell. Just to conclude here, the left are calling for revolution, Mr. Leap says. Since losing the 2016 election, their efforts to reclaim power are getting more and more radical. Their lawlessness is ever more obvious. It should be, anyway. It should be. But still, the truth, you see it every day. The truth is failing. The truth is obscured. The truth is twisted. The terminology is adjusted. The illegal activity, it's all sanitized. O'Brien says this, one does not establish a dictatorship in order to safeguard a revolution. One makes the revolution in order to establish the dictatorship. And this is something going back to what Herbert Armstrong wrote decades ago about the spread of this communist ideology in the American university and really all across American culture. And you see the radical leftist movement today, desperate for revolution. They want power. It's all about power. That's from the May issue, that little short article about, just drawing on some of the points brought out in George Orwell's book, 1984. It's from the May 2018 Trumpet magazine. When we come back, we'll dwell on this subject of truth just a little bit more. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request, No Freedom Without Law, and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Last week, I gave a program on the search for truth and went through that old radio show from Mr. Armstrong, where he talked about the four ways that we come to believe what we believe, how that we take for granted without question what we have been brought up to believe. And then there's just the desire to go along with the crowd, to conform. And then also he brought out that we believe, often we believe what we do just because we want to believe it. And then in that same show, he talked about how we have to learn, we really do have to learn how to seek the truth, how to find the truth, and how to act on the truth. But that's not being done today, which is why facts and truth and evidence doesn't matter. I mean, here is 560-some pages of evidence or facts, one would think, and yet to hear some describe or summarize that content, well, we went through that, as I say, in the first segment. Last night, we had our book club going through, we're going through the second volume of Churchill's, or rather Manchester's book on Churchill, The Wilderness Years, and it's just stunning, really, to go through some of this history from 1939 and to see what it took to finally awaken the British people. But in their defense, I mean, there were powerful, powerful people in top positions of government, heading up media outlets, the BBC, the Times, and other news agencies who were obscuring the truth. Churchill gave a speech in April of 1939 where he talked about how he'd been sounding the alarm for years and even submitting the facts to Chamberlain's government. But as he said in that House of Commons speech, the facts were not allowed to reach high ministers of the crown until they had been so modified that they did not present an alarming impression. They watered it down. They took the facts that they had been given and they changed it. They modified it. They watered it down so that when the report was finally put on the prime minister's desk, well, there's nothing alarming here. There's nothing new to report. This has all been said before. Does that sound familiar? And then you have the media again, helping to suppress the truth. As it says on page 491 of his biography, Manchester's, how that Fleet Street withheld news of the moves and countermoves in London, Warsaw, and Berlin because they knew their countrymen would disapprove. And that's all of the negotiations going on, trying to bring Britain and France and Russia together. Poland, of course, was caught in the middle between Germany and Russia. Of course, Russia eventually went into that pact with Germany right there at the last before Hitler marched into Poland. But there was Fleet Street. That's all the news agencies. That's where all the newspapers were. And they were suppressing things or withholding news. They just wouldn't cover it. If they knew it was something that the people would disapprove of. Now think about, again, a CNN report that would come out and say, look, the borders are pretty much wide open. This is how many people are coming in each year. And of these people coming in, we've got some pretty good facts. We've got some pretty good facts showing that this is how many criminals there are. And this is how many of them end up in our prison system. This is how many are guilty of murder. They don't play stories like that. because they know Americans would, well, they would react angrily to that sort of thing. And so they suppress it. I mean, all of this was happening in the 1930s. It says a lot about human nature and just how challenging it is to that go that fourth way that Mr. Armstrong described in that radio show, to learn how to seek and to find and to act upon the truth. Manchester made the point about individuals in positions of power. He said, most men in power believe what they want to believe, accepting whatever justifies their policies and convictions. You see, they go and find the facts, quote unquote, that supports their agenda. They go and find the story, the narrative, or they'll create it if they have to, that justifies their policies and convictions. They don't care about the truth. They don't care about context. They don't care about fairness or balance. They look for anything and everything to justify their policies. That's why the radical left is all of a sudden, very, very concerned about keeping families together. Never, never, never have you heard this coming from the radical left. Not until now. And now it applies only to immigrant children, illegal immigrant children. We've got to promote the family and family togetherness so that we can keep this lawless activity going on the border. Truth fails. Richard Palmer had an article a number of years ago where he brought out some examples from George Orwell's book, 1984, as well. He referenced that verse in Matthew 12 where Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Out of the abundance of the heart. And as he brought out in that article from 2009, I mean, when they start spouting nonsense, that sort of thing comes from a confused and muddled mind. Nonsensical things. Look at the language that we hear on a daily basis. What a difference. When you compare it to, just to go back to the Churchill example, and the way that he used the English language, as Edward Murrow said, he mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. He used the English language the way that it should be used. He used it to proclaim the truth. He was a masterful communicator. He wrote an essay back when he was just in his early 20s, 23 or 24, I think, called The Scaffolding of Rhetoric. And he put forward four principles to effective communication. Stephen Hayward wrote about this in his book, Churchill on Leadership. And he says the first, this is, again, to paraphrase or to draw from the lessons of that essay that Churchill wrote as a 24-year-old. The first was correctness of diction. Hayward says, knowledge of a language is measured by the nice and exact appreciation of words. There is no more important element in the teaching of rhetoric, or rather the technique of rhetoric, than the continual employment of the best possible word, Churchill wrote. And then Hayward says, Churchill generally eschewed long, multisyllabic words in favor of short words. Now, he did have longer sentences by, you know, comparing to today, but he opted for words that meant what he was trying to convey. It says, Churchill's speeches and writings follow this guide, employing short words and phrases, avoiding jargon or involved construction. Jargon and highfalutin phrases are usually employed to shade meaning, evade clarity, or mask confusion of thought. That's why that it's used. It's to obscure the truth. Now, we were talking in our trumpet meeting this morning. Richard brought out the point that a lot of people might shade the meaning some, just because we're living in such a litigious society. And then certainly if you're on record, or certainly if you're being interviewed by the FBI, you can see where human nature, being what it is, would talk in the most vague language possible, just so that you couldn't come back and find out, well, you lied under oath. But what's driving it? I think, like Mr. Leap brought out in that sidebar piece, it's just this push, this justification of your policies and convictions, and people will lie to do it. They'll change the language. They'll sanitize all of the language so that illegal is not illegal. It's just improper. It's all designed to shade the meaning, to mask what's actually happening. Just like my father said in Saving America, they cloak their activities. They cloak their behavior, their evil behavior, behind all of these neutral words, this neutral language. Churchill especially disliked bureaucratic appellations, Hayward says. He constantly demanded simplification of bureaucraties. His most famous simplification was the renaming of the local defense volunteers in World War II. He wanted them called the Home Guard. He kept watch especially against jargon. He protested referring to the poor as the lower income group and calling a truck a commercial vehicle. He dressed down civil servants who would write, "The answer is in the affirmative," wondering why they were incapable of a simple yes. Why are so many people incapable today of the simple yes? But you did get the order to stand down, is that right? Yes. Yes, we did. Instead, it's on the back burner. You see this kind of language everywhere. And a lot of it borders on ridiculous, like you heard from that testimony the other day, all the double negatives and such. There was one example that's quite humorous with Churchill in this Hayward piece. Or I guess this book, the Labor Party in 1950, they came out with a housing policy and they wanted to use the term accommodation unit instead of house. And Churchill, Hayward writes, he was the leader of the opposition at the time. He got up on the House of Commons floor and he says, "I don't know how we're going to sing our old song, Home Sweet Home. Accommodation unit, sweet accommodation unit. There's no place like our accommodation unit." Churchill said, "I hope to live to see the British democracy spit all this rubbish from their lips." That was back in 1950. Right around the time of George Orwell. He wrote his 1984 in the 1940s sometime, I forget the exact year, he wrote another famous essay, Politics and the English Language. This is from 1946. And Orwell says, "In our time, political speech and writing are largely the defense of the indefensible. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. People are imprisoned for years without trial, or shot in the back of the neck, or sent to die of scurvy in Arctic lumber camps. This is called elimination of unreliable elements." It's all got to be sanitized. It says, "The inflated style itself is a kind of euphemism. A mass of Latin words fall upon the facts like soft snow, blurring the outline and covering up all the details." Orwell said, "The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. When there is a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhaustive idioms, like a cuttlefish spurting out ink." He says, finally, In our age, there's no such thing as keeping out of politics. All issues are political issues, and politics itself is a mass of lies, evasions, folly, hatred, and schizophrenia. When the general atmosphere is bad, language must suffer. Let's conclude over in that chapter, Isaiah 59, that chapter where it says, truth fails. And you see just how closely this is connected to so many of the other evils that we see in our society today. I mean, these are comments from people back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s. Alan Bloom, we cover this in our Principles of Living class at God's College. Alan Bloom, his book, Closing of the American Mind, that came out in 1987, I believe, where he talked about value, relativism. Well, nobody knows what values are anymore. He introduced one chapter on German rationalism, talking about President Reagan in the 1980s, calling the Soviet Empire the evil empire. And of course, this offended the sensibilities of the liberal press. How could you say they're evil? You have to choose a more neutral word than evil. Bloom said in his book that the most important and most astonishing phenomenon of our time, all the more astonishing in being almost unnoticed, there is now an entirely new language of good and evil, originating in an attempt to get beyond good and evil. We're above all of that, I guess. There's no right and wrong. Bloom says, in politics, in entertainment, in religion, everywhere, we find the language connected with Nietzsche's value revolution, a language necessitated by a new perspective on the things of most concern to us, words such as charisma, lifestyle, commitment, identity, and many others, all of which can easily be traced to Nietzsche, are now practically American slang, although they, and the things which they refer, the things to which they refer, would have been incomprehensible to our fathers, not to speak of our founding fathers. How would they answer some of these questions during congressional testimony or congressional hearings? How would they have answered it back in the 1700s or the 1800s? Here in Isaiah 59, I mean, we've gone through this chapter before, but right at the outset, I think this is verse 3, where it talks about the truth. For your hands are defiled with blood and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken lies. Your tongue has muttered perverseness. None calls for justice, verse 4 says. Nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. Nobody pleads for the truth anymore. Instead, you have to hear what, as Andy McCarthy says, here come the Democrats, here comes this group, here comes this director saying there's no bias here. And it's insulting to anyone's intelligence that actually looks at it and reads the facts, that actually thinks clearly. No one's pleading for the truth. Truth is cast to the ground. And so verse 8, the memory verse, we don't know the way to peace. We just can't find it. Judgment's far from us. We're walking in darkness. Groping for the wall like a blind man, it says in verse 10. And all of it leads to verse 15, which I keep repeating. Truth fails, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. But there is hope, and it's even in this very chapter. The very last bit of it, verse 20. It says, and the Redeemer shall come to Zion, and unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, says the Eternal. Jesus Christ's return, when he returns to this earth and sets up or establishes the kingdom of God and God's government on this earth. Acts chapter 3 says he's going to restore all things. There's going to be a great restitution or restoration. The government of God is going to be restored to this earth, and it's a perfect government, a righteous government, a just government. It's a government that's established on truth. The word of God, God's word being truth, and that truth setting all of mankind free, finally. That's something that we want to be praying for. 2 Peter 3 speaks about hastening the day of Jesus Christ's return. I mean, when Jesus gave us the prayer outline in Matthew 6, I mean, right there at the start of the outline, or right there at the start of our prayers, we pray that thy kingdom comes. We pray for the kingdom of God to come to eliminate all these evils spoken of in these first many verses of Isaiah 59. As Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, wrote in The World Tomorrow, the only hope of justice, of peace, of truth, of right solutions to all this world's problems is the coming power and glory of Christ to set up world government, right government, the government of God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit some emails, I've got quite a collection of those. We'll have to get into that next week. But you can write us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.